From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. First, an update on yesterday's late-breaking report that Palestine's government was dissolved. The Palestinian Hamas movement rejected Tuesday's unilateral decision by President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah political group to dissolve the Palestinian Unity Government. Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri said Wednesday that, quote, Hamas rejects any one-sided change in the government without the agreement of all parties. No one told us anything about any decision to change, and no one consulted with us about any change in the Unity Government. Fatah acted on its own in all regards, closed quote. Fatah and Hamas have been at odds ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Palestinian elections in 2006. Hamas has ruled the impoverished and Israeli-blockaded Gaza Strip, while Fatah has set up headquarters in the occupied Palestinian territories in the West Bank. The two leading Palestinian political parties agreed in April of last year to reconcile. The move drew the ire of Israel, and Tel Aviv consequently responded by suspending the so-called peace talks with the Palestinian Authority. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has some details about the breakup of the alliance between the two factions.
President Mahmoud Abbas has told members of his Fatah movement that the government would resign within 24 hours. Another Fatah official has said the resignation is because of the government's inability to act in the Gaza Strip. Hamas ruled the coastal enclave for 7 years but stepped down last June when a consensus government was sworn in. However, the Ramallah-based government recently complained that it has been unable to extend its authority in Gaza, which was devastated by a deadly 50-day Israeli war last summer. Last month, a government delegation was also forced to cut short a trip to Gaza because of a long-running dispute with Hamas over salaries of government employees in Gaza.
And we'll have more on that tomorrow. Yesterday, we reported on what appears to be a new arms race shaping up as a part of the new Cold War that's arisen between the U.S. and Russia. Today, we'll take a closer look. After watching patiently during months of U.S. war games at Russia's doorstep, the recent announcement of deployment of tanks and other hardware in Poland and the Baltics, and possible S-300 missiles going into Ukraine, prompted Russia's President Vladimir Putin to announce Tuesday that his country would increase the size of its nuclear arsenal this year by at least 50 new intercontinental missiles. Putin also vowed to continue a major arms modernization program, including a new long-range warning radar system to monitor the country's borders. The announcement came after the U.S. proposal to increase its military presence in NATO states in Eastern Europe ratcheted up already tense relations. The increased tensions have prompted historian and author Professor Gerald Horn to say this.
This is a very dangerous turn of events. First of all, we must condemn in unvarnished terms the adventurism of the U.S. authorities in sending more armament to Russia's western borders. I think in order to understand this, we have to recognize, number one, that during the Cold War, there was a fair amount of anti-Moscow sentiment generated in the United States of America. That is to say, the Soviet Union was castigated as the evil empire. And therefore, it's very easy and simple for certain U.S. politicians to play up on that anti-Moscow sentiment today. Second of all, we now recognize retrospectively that the Cold War was more than about communism, as we were told. U.S. geostrategists now acknowledge that Russia is the most valuable territory on this small planet because it is the land bridge between the richest continent that is Europe and the continent of the future that is Asia. And therefore, the United States wants to dominate, if not control, Moscow. I'm afraid that it's difficult to be optimistic at this precise moment. We can only hope that U.S. geostrategists will recognize that their hands are full. They're trying to confront the so-called Islamic State on the Syria-Iraqi border. They're trying to confront China in the South China Sea. And one would think that that was enough and that sober heads would prevail in Washington, and therefore they would pull back from the brink and the precipice and say that the armament going to Russia's western borders will not be sent. Keep in mind that the United States pursues what could be called a strategy of chaos. That is to say, before the Ukraine crisis of February 2014, There was concern in Washington that Germany was drawing too close to both Moscow and Beijing. Germany, as you know, has been a major investor in Russia over the last decade or more. With the Ukraine crisis that has erupted, the United States has pressured Germany to put sanctions on Russia, and now it's upping the ante by sending these armaments to Russia's western borders. This is in part a strategy to keep Berlin in line. A few weeks ago, you may recall that after a very frigid interlude between Moscow and Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry met with President Putin in Sochi. I would now urge and encourage Secretary of State John Kerry to pack his bags and head off to Moscow to meet with President Putin sooner rather than later to put a cap on this dangerous turn of events.
The current round of posturing by the U.S. and its NATO allies failed to put the damper on this month's 2015 European Games in Baku, Azerbaijan, despite a boycott by senior American and European heads of state. In a snub to Baku over the Azerbaijani government's refusal to sign on to a U.S.-drafted resolution condemning Moscow for its reunification with Crimea, U.S. and EU officials echoed the 1980 U.S. boycott of the Moscow Olympics by staying away en masse from the inaugural session of the international multi-sport event representing the National Olympic Committees of Europe. The Games began in Baku on June 12th and will continue until June 28th and feature more than 6,000 athletes from 50 National Olympic Committees competing in 20 sports. Although the entire event has been essentially blacked out in the Western media, we were able to get a report from one attendee, Dmitry Babich, journalist and political analyst based in Moscow. He told us about the games being played by some around the games, and the reaction of both Russian officials and Russian people in the street to the newest provocations from Washington when we spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Wednesday.
I've just returned from Baku, which is the capital of the Republic of Azerbaijan. It's a not very big country, 9 million people, and right now it hosts the so-called European Games. These games were certified by the European Olympic Committee. It's the first such experience. The whole idea is to give a chance to smaller countries such as Azerbaijan to host the games. There are 50 nations participating. Some of them are not considered to be European by the majority, but still European in their culture. And this includes Israel. This includes countries like the former republics of the Soviet Union, including, for example, Georgia and Armenia, located right close to Azerbaijan. And there are 6,000 athletes who came to Baku.
Wow.
And what was most astounding is that the mainstream press in the world simply refused to cover it. When the first day started and I was there, there was just one report on the BBC and it didn't say almost anything about the games. It just talked about some human rights activists in Azerbaijan who protest against these games. And it was a shame because this is not the kind of treatment that Azerbaijan is expected to get. And what was most astounding, you know, there was not a single head of state from the European Union at the opening. Yeah. There was President Putin from Russia. There was President Lukashenko from Belarus. There were several presidents of the former Soviet republics. And there was the Prince of Monaco. And to Azeris, this was like a slap in the face because they have been working, the whole country has been working to host these games for 2.5 years. It was a big political controversy in the country whether it was worth spending money on it. And that's what they got from the Western world.
It sounds like a regional version of the 1980s Olympics.
It sounds like a regional version of the Olympic Games in Sochi last year.
Right.
But last year it was a lot more indecent because with Azerbaijan, at least there were no lies on the side of the West. I mean, the whole story with Russia supposedly discriminating against gay athletes and against gay spectators, That was just a big lie. I mean, it had nothing to do with reality. Not a single gay athlete had any problems during the games, and there were dozens of gay athletes. There were hundreds and thousands of gay spectators, you know, people who were invited to Sochi. None of them ever complained of any mistreatment. And I will remind you that there were literally thousands of articles in the American press, in the press of the EU countries, for months before the games, saying that these athletes would be arrested, they would be imprisoned, they're so brave to go to Sochi, and this was just a big lie, all of it.
That was the one thing that came across, and the other thing was that the toilets don't work.
Yeah, and it was an invention by a person who had actually worked with the Russian media before going to Sochi. I mean, right. Some of the people who wrote about these bad toilets and about dirty water, they actually had worked for some of the Russian English language media, financed by the state, by the way. But these people absolutely had no moral qualms about anything. This is the problem with some of the Western correspondents working in Moscow. They have literally hundreds of friends there. They go to excellent parties. There is a lot of footage of that. And then when they leave the country, they say that, oh, these were years of fear, intimidation. It was so hard to work here. I mean, people just lie so easily.
So let's talk about some of what you saw. I know that they had wrestling, karate, canoe, gymnastics, taekwondo. What did you see?
Well, there are 20 kinds of sports, and the games are still on. I mean, they will continue until the 28th of June. I could only attend the first 3 days. And to me, the most astounding was the moment when an Armenian wrestler basically took the gold medal on the first day.
Wow.
And he was an ethnic Armenian, but a Russian citizen. Mm-hmm. And you know that Azerbaijan had a war with Armenia in the early 90s, and it was still a huge problem. So it was a big achievement when an Armenian team still came to the games in Baku. It's like inviting a Palestinian team to Israel, you know.
And winning a gold medal.
So for me, although I'm not a great specialist in sports, unfortunately, this was the most touching moment. And it was too bad that instead of dwelling on this, you know, the real problem and the real solution, the Western media kept talking about, Aliyev's family, you know, the family in power in Azerbaijan being corrupt, the Western media not being read well enough in Azerbaijan, all that stuff. And, you know, the same words that were used against the Russian Olympics in Sochi, you know, that Azerbaijan took upon itself the obligations under OSCE, under the Council of Europe. And everyone understands that if Azerbaijan had not disappointed the EU at the recent summit of the Eastern Partnership in Riga, none of this would have happened. But Azerbaijan refused to sign a resolution calling what happened in Crimea an annexation by Russia.
Right.
And that was the punishment that came days afterwards. Mm. And it was such a nasty, ugly punishment. I mean, not coming to the games, not coming to the home where you were invited. I think it's an insult and it's a humiliation primarily to the person who didn't come, not to the host who invited you.
Yeah, I mean, and particularly Olympics. I mean, the Olympic spirit is supposed to be exactly the contrary, and that's one of the, you know, that's from Greece. That's the grandfather of Western culture. That's something really fundamental to this value-oriented culture that they brag about all the time.
Yes, and I think that we're witnessing something very bad, you know, happening with the sports right now. Let me remind you that in the 20th century, the sports events, they served to legitimize, I don't want to say regimes, they legitimized states. For example, Finland was punished after the war for being allied to Nazi Germany for several years. There was even a kind of a control commission, you know, which consisted of the Brits, the Americans, and the Russians. And if you read the Finnish textbooks, history textbooks, they all say that this all ended in 1952 when Finland housed, hosted the Olympic Games in Helsinki in 1952.
Right.
When Moscow was allowed to host Olympic Games, the permission was given in the mid-70s. It was, in fact, a sort of a reward for the Helsinki agreements.
Right.
And everyone understood that, okay, now there is peace in Europe. The war has finally ended. And now, Russia or the Soviet Union became a full-fledged member of the international community with Olympic Games taking place there. And now it doesn't work anymore because the former Ukrainian president Yanukovych, he hosted the World Cup on football, soccer, in 2012.
Right.
Ukraine spent a huge amount of money on that. They did it together with Poland, a country which was hostile to Yanukovych. So the president expected to get some respect in return. And what did he get? In a year, it transpired that the West not only wanted to topple him, but the West would not mind if the Maidan activists killed him. When Mr. Kerry accused Yanukovych of fleeing in the middle of the night, I'm sorry, but Kerry was speaking like a hypocrite at that moment, because everyone understood that if Yanukovych got into the hands of the extreme right activists who actually did most of the fighting on Maidan, they would simply kill him.
Right.
And then we would have Mr. Kerry saying that, okay, he was killed, so he is no longer the president.
Right.
It's just a lot of hypocrisy. I think Mr. Kerry would have also fled in similar situation.
Oh, for sure.
But the problem is that, Yanukovych had this World Cup, and it turned out that it didn't mean anything. Russia had the Sochi Olympics, and the United States and the EU used this moment to stir trouble in Ukraine and to topple a legitimately elected government there.
Right.
Now, in Azerbaijan, a small country, 9 million people, they pulled off this huge expense, $1 billion in infrastructure investments. They pulled out that huge sum. And what did they get? Not a single European leader, not a single leader from the EU countries coming to these Olympic Games. Thousands of athletes from Europe and not a single head of state. So basically for these people, for these people who are now calling themselves the Western elite, for them, sports and sports events, these things don't mean anything. And that's very dangerous because sports traditionally in the 20th century, it was one of the guarantees against war. It is just absurd when people participate in sports events and then next day they kill each other. This is against the logic of human behavior. And now, unfortunately, sports it just doesn't mean anything for the people like Obama or Merkel or Hollande.
Yeah, it's against the logic of human survival, too, which is the part that really troubles me. Let's go maybe to the context items, like the placement of U.S. military hardware in the Baltics and Poland, right up to the border now with tanks and a division's worth of material. And the discussion of installing S-300s in Ukraine. What's going on and what are people saying about this in Moscow?
Well, the Moscow's main concern is, the deployment of from 3,000 to 5,000 NATO troops, primarily Americans, in the countries bordering Russia, such as the Baltic countries, such as Poland, and, in the south, these are countries bordering Ukraine, but also close to Russia's borders. These are Romania and Bulgaria. All of these countries, according to the plans published by the New York Times and confirmed by the Polish defense minister, Tomasz Simoniak, all of these countries would get from 700 to 200 U.S. soldiers on their soil, with about 1,200 military vehicles, including 250 tanks. And this is the first escalation in Eastern Europe since 1990. Well, actually, since 1987. Since 1987, the military buildup in that area was never resumed. you know, the Soviet army was withdrawn from places like East Germany and Czechoslovakia and other countries, from Hungary. So it's very strange that right now, 25 years after the big de-escalation, we're going to have 5,000 American troops there. This is something that Russians don't understand. And as for S-300s in Ukraine, the aim is not to protect Ukraine. The aim is to prevent Russia from supplying food and medicine to the people in Transnistria. Transnistria is now blockaded. There is Moldova, you know, the mother country which wants to return Transnistria to its fold on the west. There is hostile Ukraine on the east. There is Mr. Saakashvili, who is now the governor of Odessa, you know, the seaport which Transnistria used to communicate with the world. So the only way Russia can help these hundreds of thousands of people to survive is by flying food and medicine for them. And not even arms, but food and medicine in the first place. And the Ukrainian authorities say, we're going to put S-300 there. And if you try to give them food and medicine, we're going to shoot you down. That's the message from them.
So it's basically making a flashpoint for a potential war between the U.S. and Russia.
Well, I mean, there are so many flashpoints. Right. And the whole problem is that when you talk to Western leaders, they seem not to have any history education. They say Russia is aggressive. That's why we put American tanks in Estonia. I mean, look at the map of the Soviet Union and NATO in 1990. Estonia was then a part of the Soviet Union. Russia voluntarily, peacefully ceded all of these territories to the Western sphere of influence. Russia did not make any hysteria when Estonia became a NATO member in 2004. We were all told that in exchange we would get, peaceful Estonia, because Estonia, being a member of NATO, would feel secure. It would not feel the need to provoke Russia by unneeded statements or actions. And what do we see there? We now see there are hundreds of American tanks. They are in just like a 20 or 30 minute drive to St. Petersburg, Russia's second biggest city. We never had such situation, even in the times of Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany was a lot closer to Russia than the United States. Now we have American tanks in Estonia at a short distance from St. Petersburg. And the United States is telling us that we are dangerous. We want to attack them. We want to attack them in Estonia.
Yeah, right. one of the things that's being handled, where this is being reported at all in the U.S. media, one of the salves that goes along with the report is that, you know, it's only a division, and it's not an actual military threat because of its size. But in actuality, the dispersal of these troops it goes to the local militaries of each of these countries as a command and control and advise force with equipment to help outfit and supplement the equipment that's already locally owned and staged. And so you have actually an invasion threat from these countries, don't you?
I would just remind you that for dozens of years, for decades after the end of the Cold War, it was a mantra which both Russian liberals and Western strategists repeated, that a war between Moscow and NATO is impossible. NATO is just a sphere of affluence and peace getting closer and closer to Russia. And now we have this sphere of affluence and peace coming closer with 5,000 American troops, with 1,200 tanks and military vehicles. And this is supposed to be democracy, stability, and prosperity. I'm sorry, but this is not the way prosperous and stable countries behave. They lied to Americans, saying that, oh, we're so much afraid of Russia. When you are afraid, you don't try to provoke your neighbor. You try to appease him by all means. Right. And that's something that the Baltic leaders have been doing before Stalin's invasion in 1939, 1940, look at history books, how they behave. They behave very differently from the Baltic leaders right now. The Estonian dictator Tast, who ruled Estonia before Stalin's invasion, even Western history books suspect him of being an NKVD agent. He cooperated probably even with the Soviet military intelligence. He so much wanted to avoid a confrontation with the Soviet Union. Yep. And these people say, oh, we're so afraid of Russia. That's why we are in South Russia. That's why we destroy its monuments. That's why we say that the Nazis were better than communists. And this is all because we are so afraid of Russia.
Well, you can see that exhibited also at the UN Security Council. Lithuania is a member there. And if nothing else, a lot of nonsense comes out of her mouth, the permanent representative, but she does not act like she's afraid of Russia at all.
Absolutely. And that's why I also don't believe the American leaders when they say, oh, we need so badly to protect the Baltic countries from Russia. We need to deploy their weapons. We need to have the biggest military exercise in Eastern Europe, with 700 tanks landing in Latvia several weeks ago. I don't believe them because I don't think Mr. Obama is so insensitive and so devoid of diplomatic understanding to believe the stories from Lithuanian or Estonian authorities that they're afraid of Russia. When people are afraid of a big neighbor, they don't behave the way Lithuanians and Estonians do. They quite on the contrary, they try not to irritate in any way, their neighbor. Comparing Putin to Hitler, as the Lithuanian president did, promising to send weapons to Ukraine, this is not the way you behave with someone whom you suspect of being able to invade you.
Yeah. Looking forward, do you see any way out of this mess?
Well, I hope that the public opinion in the West at a certain moment will start to wake up. This is my only hope, because I don't believe in the integrity of Western journalists. I don't believe military solution to the conflicts. I would say that the Western public opinion just has to wake up to facts. There are 4 million people in Eastern Ukraine blockaded by the Ukrainian government. It's written in the New York Times. Read it. When someone says he imposes a food blockade on 4 million people, this person is dangerous. He should not be given standing ovations in the American and the Canadian Parliament, as Mr. Poroshenko was given these standing ovations when his artillery, were destroying Donetsk and Lugansk. This is just beyond good and evil. And I hope that the Western opinion, Western public opinion, will wake up to this fact. If it doesn't, then let me remind you of the story with the World War II. The problem was that until 1941, just about everyone cooperated with Hitler, including the Soviet Union and Mr. Stalin. They all thought that they would somehow outwit Mr. Hitler, that he was not serious about what he wrote in his terrible book, Mein Kampf. And in reality, Hitler did exactly what he had written in the early 20s. And the countries that cooperated with him most, these countries were the first to suffer. And they suffered most during the World War II. I think that the Western public opinion should wake up to the fact that it's dangerous to play with cruel political leaders such as the Ukrainian President Poroshenko. The history of the World War II shows that this game always ends badly for everyone, not only for the cruel dictator himself, but also for people who think they may get dividends from cooperating with him.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.